I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week, our writer and culture critic Jimmy Israel, with us from Washington, D.C. Also here in D.C., civil rights attorney Arsalan Iftikhar. Sports Illustrated reporter Pablo Torre joins us from our bureau in New York City. And in Boston, Neil Minkoff. He is a doctor who primarily works as a healthcare consultant. He's also a contributor to the National Review. Take it away, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Hey, fellas, welcome to the shop. How we doing?
Obamacare.
What up?
We're doing good.
What's up, Doc? What's up, Neil?
Just living the dream.
I know that's right. It's been a while, man, so I'm glad to have you in. Listen, man, yesterday
Thanks.
The Supreme Court ruled on the Affordable Care Act. They kind of put a ring on it, also called Obamacare. And it's surprised a lot of people that conservative Chief Justice John Roberts served as a swing voter in favor of the law. Wow, that was kind of surprising, wasn't it, Michelle?
Well, who knows whether what people really...
I lost a lot of money on that one.
Okay, well, so, yes. So, I think the thing that really struck people is that the fact that he agreed with the four liberal justices, so-called, on the individual mandate, the requirement that people have health care or pay a penalty, is within Congress's power to impose taxes. Now, President Obama was very obviously pleased with the ruling. Here's what he said during a press conference shortly after the decision was announced.
I'm as confident as ever that when we look back 5 years from now, or 10 years from now, or 20 years from now, we'll be better off because we had the courage to pass this law and keep moving forward.
As you would imagine, the Republicans' presumptive presidential nominee Mitt Romney also responded to the ruling. I'll just play a short clip from what he had to say.
Let's make clear that we understand what the court did and did not do. What the court did today was say that Obamacare does not violate the Constitution. What they did not do was say that Obamacare is good law or that it's good policy.
Oh, my goodness, man. That dude runs on batteries. Thanks for that, Michelle. You know what? So this is one of the most anticipated Supreme Court rulings in recent history. Some people say this ruling could make or break Obama's reelection effort. Now, we've all heard the analysis in the 24 hours, but you know what? I'm curious about what you guys think. Doc Neil Minkoff, you know, as a healthcare consultant, you're probably the closest to what industry insiders, you know, are saying right about now. So, you know what? Give us the inside scoop.
Well, I mean, to me, the most important thing about yesterday isn't the mandate. I mean, that's the sexy thing, and that's the big constitutional principle. And the thing that to me is getting lost in the shuffle is now that states could potentially have the ability to opt out of expansion of Medicaid. Medicaid expansion has been the thing that has frightened me the most about this, because expansion of Medicaid puts a tremendous strain on the private sector in healthcare, because Medicaid is so underfunded and pays below cost. Those costs, that's called the public payer shortfall, and private payers are expected to make up that difference. And about 10 to 15 million people were supposed to be covered by the expansion of Medicaid. There is no state in the union right now where Medicaid isn't already underwater before expansion. So if states opt out, the whole balance shifts here.
What I'm wondering also, Doc, is what direction is Romney going to criticize this from? You know, because this is more or less just kind of the bad boy style remix of a Romney idea. You know what I mean? So where
yeah,
you know, it's like the same lyrics, different beat.
But I lived through that here, and here's the thing that I've never understood. So I've been in healthcare in Massachusetts for my whole career, and the thing that I never understood is why anybody would use this as the model. Massachusetts is an unusual state. It's small. It is reasonably affluent. It's reasonably homogenous, and the Massachusetts economy is run by healthcare industry. And we went from 94% covered to 98% covered, and I've never understood why that served as an example for places in the country that aren't as homogenous and are at like 60% coverage.
Well, that's been Romney's argument on the campaign trail, which is that, you know, his attitude was good idea for Massachusetts. It's not a model for the rest of the country. And that is the kind of the basis of his argument. But I think that I don't know that he's made it particularly effectively.
I don't know either.
Arsalan, what do you think?
Hey, Trey.
Well, you know, obviously, you know, for us legal dorks out there, you know, to look at the 193-page opinion, what's really interesting is not the fact that Chief Justice John Roberts eventually went with the liberal wing of the court, But it seems from the actual text of the opinion that, you know, the conservative wing, Scalia, Alito, Thomas, with Justice Anthony Kennedy, who wanted to, you know, get rid of the entire law, were basically writing their opinion as though they were going to be the majority opinion. They actually referred to the, quote, Ginsburg dissent, which makes it seem to us legal dorks out there that Chief Justice John Roberts, you know, flipped at the last moment. I don't know if Scalia, you know, insulted his mama or what happened there, but, you know, it showed
gotta
that.
Gotta hate when that happens.
But here's my question. How do we know that he went with the liberal wing of the court as opposed to that the liberal wing of the court went with him? See, this is the part that I always am fascinated. Well, how do we know that he wasn't driving that train? Because we know that he was very active in shaping that Citizens United decision. And we also know that the thing that's most surprised the conservatives is that he didn't base his decision on the Commerce Clause, but rather on tax law.
Right. So the dissent was actually authored by Anthony Kennedy, who is traditionally that swing vote, the Sandra Day O'Connor traditional swing vote. He actually authored the dissent, you know, as though they were going to be the majority, meaning that they were going to have Roberts as the fifth vote. That makes it seem to me that he was the swing. It was a last-minute thing. Again, we don't know why. Some people are saying, you know, he was trying to, you know, as Chief Justice, uphold the sanctity of the Supreme Court as not, you know, a political entity, whatever, what have you. But it's really, really interesting moving forward, you know, what kind of role Roberts will now play in the court.
Can I just briefly get Pablo in on this? Just because, I mean, you're looking at this as a consumer, pretty much, of healthcare.
Right.
You know what I mean? I mean,
I'm
just wondering what you think about it, just briefly, if you can, because we want to get to all the other stuff, too.
Yeah, actually, off Arsalan's point about the bipartisanship and that sort of image of the court, I mean, to me, looking at this, I was all for, you know, like the idea that the court could rise above kind of an election season and be dispassionate and all that, even if it costs Roberts sort of points with the GOP. But to me, there's a couple of – there are two quick things I want to mention that I think in the longer term are probably huge blows against – liberals, which is the fact that the Commerce Clause, which is clearly designed to limit the powers of federal government, is pretty much gutted under Roberts' opinion. And second, that the rebranding of Obamacare as a tax. I mean, I was just looking at, you know, GOP conservative sites and everybody's proclaiming, you know, the largest tax increase in the history of the world is what Obamacare is. And it is an election year. And I think that could be turn out to be a huge consolation prize for conservatives coming out of this.
Well, you know, the only other point I'd make about this is that one of the things that's intrigued me all along is how many polls say that if you take the label off of it and just ask people about the constituent parts of the law, how many Republicans support it, how many Republicans support it, and how many self-described conservatives support it, as long as you don't label it an Obama initiative. And so to me, that then becomes the question, is it the substance or is it the deliverer of the substance?
Is that remix.
Thank you. If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're having our weekly visit to the Barbershop with writer Jimmy Israel, civil rights attorney Arsalan Iftikhar, Dr. Neil Minkoff, he's a contributor to the National Review and a healthcare consultant and a doctor, and Sports Illustrated reporter Pablo Torre. Back to you, Jimmy.
All right, Michelle. Well, you know what? Let's keep it moving, and let's talk about contempt. The Republican-controlled House of Representatives voted yesterday to hold Attorney General Eric Holder in contempt of Congress. They want him to turn over documents related to the gunwalking operation called Fast and Furious.
Well, that was supposed to track gun buyers in Mexico with the hope that it would eventually lead authorities to high-level drug lords. And some of those guns have been traced to crimes, including one that resulted in the death of a U.S. Border Patrol agent. But the thing that always has fascinated me about this is that how did this become a partisan issue when the operation started under the George W. Bush administration? It started under the previous administration.
Mm-hmm.
So how did this become this big partisan fight? Arsalan, you know?
Well, I mean, it's part of, you know, the playbook of the, you know, Republican obstructionists in Congress. I mean, this was political kabuki theater. There was a recent exclusive article in Fortune magazine, which basically highlighted the fact that the ATF was actually not purposely letting these straw purchases go through. They were actually trying to prosecute, but the prosecutors in Arizona were not willing to bring charges. You know, there's a lot, and obviously, you know, this vote taking place on the same day as the healthcare ruling, the vast majority of the Democratic caucus walked out of the vote. They didn't even vote against it. I mean, so this is something that is going to be really interesting moving forward.
What do you think, Jimmy? What do you think?
I think Eric Holder should just take the hit, you know, with some dignity.
Well, he doesn't have a choice.
Right. I'm saying, I mean, you know, he should just do like Ali North. And I mean, because you know, the way of it is when you work for the president, you know, you take the gig knowing that at some point you might have You might be that dude. You might be G. Gordon Liddy.
G. Gordon Liddy broke the law. I just want to mention that.
Okay, my fault. But
you're saying that you think it is political, or what do you think? Or do you think, what is it that you're saying?
I think both and. Okay. I think both and. I think he should let history vindicate him if there is any vindication. But in the between time, he should take the charge and keep it in motion.
Neil, what do you think?
You know, this is a plague on both your houses feeling for me. I feel the same way about this when I feel about contempt charges in the prior administration. It's an election year. It's a big issue. It's going to get people excited. And it's a bright, shiny toy for us to all pay attention to.
Yeah. I just think Congress comes off of this just looking even more dysfunctional. I mean, just the theatrics of everything. Obviously, there are real issues. The death of a federal agent, Brian Terry. But it seems dysfunctional, and also on a separate note, it also ruins my Googling for Vin Diesel movies. Now there's all this stuff fluttering.
Well played.
Right.
All right, Michelle. You know what? Let's talk about sports. Pablo, P Dog. Are you hot to talk about the congressional baseball game last night? No, I'm just
that barely qualified as a game.
I'm just kidding. You know what?
That'll be fun to write about.
Right. Let's talk about the NBA draft instead. No big surprises really from last night's picks. We had Kentucky's. Anthony Davis went to the New Orleans Hornets as first pick. Shout out to Kentucky. But Pablo, your attention was on the 16th pick, Royce White, who went to the Houston Rockets. In a profile you wrote for this week's Sports Illustrated, you called him, quote, the most perplexing process in Thursday's NBA draft.
I think it's prospect. Jimmy.
Didn't I say prospect?
Well, both.
No, I didn't.
The process was perplexing. Jimmy, I got you on this.
And what's really scary is he's actually wearing his glasses.
Right.
Well, so that frightens me. What could be?
At any rate, Pablo, unpack it for us, man.
Yeah, well, basically, Royce White was the first prospect to come out with a mental illness before the NBA draft. And I did some research on this. It seems like he's the only prospect in any professional sport, at least the big three, to do so. And there's only, for context, there's only one active NBA player right now who's admitted to a mental illness, and that's Delonte West, who has been suffering from bipolar disorder. But this is a prospect. I mean, this is a guy with millions of dollars on the line. And if you look at even the interviews that the guys who were drafted gave last night, you know, they're still in boilerplate mode. They're still not going to say anything risky. But here you have this guy who's putting this issue, which is such a hot-button, stigmatized issue.
Which is what? You haven't said what it is. He's an anxiety disorder,
right? He has generalized anxiety disorder and a severe fear of flying, which is...
Wow.
As everybody has been noting, you know, a controversial and potentially very, you know, counterproductive thing to confess. But Royce White, his legacy, I mean, we talk about all these, what comes out of the NBA draft, a lot doesn't. We don't really know anything until 10 years hence. But we know that we have now a player to come out with a mental illness and be drafted number 16, which is a huge, huge legacy in my mind when it comes to other players potentially becoming more open about this.
Arsalan.
Yeah, well, you know, people talk about, well, you know, should people draft Royce White because of this general anxiety disorder? And, you know, the answer is if you feel it's right. I mean, Houston thought that it was right. I was hoping he'd slide to number 21 so my Boston Celtics could pick him up. But, I mean, you know, it's like...
You're here.
It's like any, you know, it's like a team not drafting someone because of, you know, bulging discs in their back or a knee injury.
But they could
things
easily
like...
have said that they, the reason, one of the things that's interesting is you are the civil rights lawyer here. And so technically you could say, well, this is covered under the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Yeah,
so
and
this
that's
is
a whole fascinating
and so,
discussion.
But,
yeah.
but like pregnancy, there's all kinds of ways to lie about it. I mean, you could say, well, it really isn't that. It's not because of this. Well, not that he would be pregnant. Let me just clarify that. I'm just saying that employers can say, well, it really isn't that I didn't hire you because you're pregnant.
Right.
It's not that I didn't hire you because of your disability. It's something else entirely. You just don't fit into our program. And who's to say they're wrong?
Right. And there's no way to prove that in a court of law. I think, you know, what. Piggybacking off what Pablo said, I think it is important to, you know, bring this into the limelight. You know, we have people like Ron Artest, Meta World Peace, you know, who's talked about his issues with mental illness as well. Again, these are not prospects or processes, as Jimmy would say. But, you know, it does, you know, I think it does open the door for other potential prospects in coming years to be more forthcoming about issues that they might have make it more normalized.
But Dr. Minkoff, you know, one of the things I was curious about, though, in your mind, is that is this good for him? I mean, I, you know, and obviously he's an adult, he's a grown man, and he has a right to make decisions in his own best interest. But you think again, you know, constant travel in the NBA. It's not like, you know, everybody knows John Madden has a fear of flying and right. he can take the bus. But you're talking about one game every week.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You can talk about multiple games, multiple cities over the course, 82 games over the course of a full season. So, Neil, what do you think?
Well, I mean, there are those who say that the best thing for a phobia like fear of flying is an immersion technique where you right. actually just get exposed to hours and hours and hours and hours in the air, and eventually you feel more comfortable with it, which is something that I actually think is good and works. But I have a, you know, what I'm worried about with this guy, and I wanted him on the Celtics too, what I'm worried about with this kid isn't now. I'm worried about what happens when he actually starts playing in the NBA. The NBA is a brutal, brutal environment with just the most horrible slurs hurled at each other on the court, with people questioning each other's manhood and their abilities, and homophobic slurs getting mm-hmm. used like constant. And he has opened the door up for his life to just be incredibly painful over the next 82 mm-hmm. games. And Houston doesn't have a tough guy enforcer to have his back.
Well, and once he throws a bow, I mean, he's 6'8", 260-some pounds. Once he throws a bow at him, I think that they'll shut their mouth.
Well, you know what? I agree with that. I second that emotion. But by the same token, you know what? I don't know that it matters much. I mean, he's lived this long with this disability. Yeah. And so he should go forward.
He'll be fine.
Yeah, he'll be fine.
What I would say is that if I were Royce White and I grew to really like the guy after spending so much time with him, I don't know if I could have done that. You know, I don't know if I would. His agent, you know, the people in his inner circle were all saying, you know, maybe rethink coming out with this at all, ever. You know, you didn't have to.
I think it was brave.
Good for
and
him.
It was just incredibly, incredibly brave. And, you know, I think when you look forward to what mental illness in sports looks like, I think what you want is it to be treated like any other sort of injury, disease, whatever, that could be managed. There's a huge stigma there, and it's intangible, which is a huge, huge problem for a business that's built on measurables and trying to wrap your mind around every little thing.
I can't imagine. I can't imagine you're even being able to write a piece like this 20 years ago or 10 years ago.
Yes,
this is really
completely.
A very interesting era.
He's a pioneer, definitely.
Pablo Torre is a reporter for Sports Illustrated. That's who was talking just now. He was with us from our NPR studios in New York. From Boston, Neil Minkoff. He is a doctor who primarily works as a healthcare consultant. He's also a contributor to the National Review. With us in Washington, D.C., Arsalan Iftikhar, civil rights attorney and founder of themuslimguide.com, and Jimmy Israel, writer and culture critic, also adjunct professor of film and social media at Cuyahoga Community College. Thank you so much.
Peace.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Yep.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more on Monday.